Let's begin. Perek Dalet is where we're up to. We took a brief hiatus from Kohelet to discuss Chanukah last week. We are back to Kohelet. Perek Dalet. Where's Perek Dalet? And what page are we on in the...
It's 877.
877 in the Jerusalem Bible, Koran Tanakh. Kuf Ayin Zayin. That's my Tanakh, it's Kuf Ayin Zayin. Alright. Vishavti ani va'er'e et kol ha'ashukim asher nasim tachat ha'shamash. I turned, I saw all of the oppression, or all of the oppressed under the sun. V'hinei dim'at ha'ashukim ve'en lahem menachem. Behold the tear of the oppressed, with none to comfort them. U'miyad oshkehem koach. The strength is in the hands of the oppressors. Ve'en lahem menachem. That there is none to comfort them. V'shabeach ani et hametim shekvar metu min ha'chayim asher hem ha'chayim adena. And then I praised the dead who are already dead over the living who are still alive. V'tov mishnehem et asher aden lo haya. Better than both is the one who never was. Better than which both? The living and the dead. Better than both is never to have been born. Asher lo ra'a et ma'aseh hara asher nasa tachat ha'shamash. Because one who was never born never saw all the evil under the sun. V'ra'iti ani et kol amal v'et kol kishon ma'aseh. I saw all of the toil and all the value of deed. Kihi kin'at ish mere'eyu. Which is all of the result of jealousy, one against the other. Gamze hevel utruach. This too is vanity and broken spirit. Haksil choveket yadav v'ochelet b'saro. The fool clasps his hands and eats his flesh. Tov meloch haftnachat mimeloch hofnayim amal utruach. Better a spoonful of minucha, of rest, than two fistful of toil and broken spirit. V'shavti ani ve'ere hevel tachat ha'shamash. Again I turned and I saw vanity under the sun. Yesh echad ve'en sheni. There is one, but not two. Gam ben va'ach ein lo. Neither son nor brother has he. Ve'en ketz l'chol amalo, with no end to all of his toil, gam eino lo tisba osher, his eye will never be satiated from the wealth. Ulemi ani amel umechaseret nafshi mitova, and to whom therefore, or for whom therefore do I toil? All of this is vanity, v'inyan rahu, and a evil matter. Tovim ha'shnayim min ha'echad, ashiyesh lahem sechar tov ba'amalam. Two are better than one, for there is greater reward for their toil. Ki im yipolo ha'echad yakim et chavero. For if one falls, the second will pick him up. V'ilu ha'echad sheyipol, v'ein sheni lahakimo. But if there's only one and he falls, there is no second to assist. Gam yimishkavu shnayim. Or two can warm each other. One with whom who is going to warm him. And if one will be attacked, two together can assist, can protect. Three-plied cord will not be easily broken. Tov yeled misken v'chacham mimelech zaken uksil. The young, poor king, wise man, is better than the old, foolish king. Asher lo yada lizeher od, who was no longer able to care or to be careful. Mibet hasurim yatza limloch, out of the jail, he emerged to reign. Ki gam b'malchuto nolad rash. In his kingdom too shall be born poverty or evil. Ra'iti et kol ha'chayim ha'malchim tachat ha'shamash. So all of life under the sun. Imayelad ha'sheni ha'she'amot tachtav, with the second child who will stand in his stead. Ein ketz l'chol ha'am l'chol ha'sheya lifnehem. There is no end to all of the people and to that which was. Gam ha'achronim lo yismuchuvo, in the future they won't rejoice in him. Ki gam zehevel v'ra'ayon ruach. This to his vanity and broken spirit. I would stop here. I would not include Pasuk Yud Zayin in this speech for the simple reason. Pasuk Yud Zayin, Shmor Raglecha Kasher Telecha Beta Elokim, guard your feet as you go to the house of the Lord. V'karov Lishmoa Mite Takzilim Zavach, better to listen than to offer sacrifices of fools. Why would I not include this in the previous speech? What indication is there that we have a change of speaker? Pasuk Yud Zayin. Two things. First of all, it changes person. The rest of this parak was in first person. Ani amel umechaser et nafshi mitova. For whom am I toiling? Veraiti et kol amel. All that I will do. This last pasuk Yud Zayin shifts to second person. Shmor aglecha. Guard yourself. Be careful as you go to the house of the Lord. One reason. Second indication that this last pasuk is not part of this speaker. God. Shem Hashem, Elohim. Shem Hashem does not exist in this parak at all. For reasons we will address. But Shem Hashem isn't there. Until Pasuk Yud Zayin, suddenly we have a change of speaker. And in the very first phrase, we reintroduce Shem Hashem into the equation. Indication that we are dealing with a different personality. Who that personality is, Bezrat Hashem, in a couple of weeks' time we will have an opportunity to address. But for now, I think it's agreed that this parak, or this speech, or this next section, starts at the beginning of the parak and concludes at Pasuk Tet Zayin. What is actually going on, we have to see, but that's, I think, just from structure, sufficient to see that this last pasuk belongs in a different context. I think I mentioned this once before. There are a few places in Kohelet where you can see that whoever divided the chapters clearly understood the book not only differently, but beyond rhyme and reason. Because there's no question that Pasuk Yud Zayin belongs together with Pasuk, with Perakei. There's just, thematically they're connected, textually they're connected, however you understand the book. Perek Dalet Pasuk Yud Zayin is a continuation that leads right into Perek Hei Pasuk Aleph. Al yimaher lotzi davar lifnei elokim ki elokim b'shamayim v'ata al haaretz. Be careful, don't be quick to criticize God. God is in the heavens, you are on earth. It's one connection, it's one thing. Why on earth you would divide Dalet Yud Zayin from Hei Aleph is beyond my understanding. As I said before, the chapter division is not of Jewish origin. I'm not beholden to it. I'm not bound by it. But in a few places in Kohelet, you see that it was almost like they stuck the pin in the book and saw, okay, we'll divide the parak there. Because there's really very little logic to it. That's an aside. Who is our speaker? Who is our speaker? Somebody said it but whispered it. I didn't hear. Is it the Nehne? Is that our friend the hedonist and the who wants to eat, enjoy the ride, and not do anything? No, clearly. Is it the Yirei Elokim?
No.
No. I think that's granted. Is it the Chacham? Philosopher who speaks about wisdom and the value of wisdom and understanding? No. So by process of elimination, who's left?
Amal.
But it's more than just process of elimination. Indications that it is in fact the Amal who is speaking. The whole topic is about Amel. Lemi ani Amel Amal umechaseret nafshi. For whom am I working? What am I doing? Ve'itit kol Amal tachat Hashemesh v'inei kinat ish merei eyu. I assessed all of toil under the heaven, and I decided that it was the result of X, Y, and Z. He's assessing. He's evaluating the concept of toil, effort, kishron maaseh. In this parak, the word Amal is also described as kishron maaseh, the value of the achievement of deeds. Asiya amelut, in at least in the context of Kohelet, are interchangeable. To do, to build, to create, to achieve. Baniti li, as he said in Perek Bet, baniti li pardasim, and he planted and he built and he created. All of this part of the theme of the Amal. So now we know who's speaking. Now we can break down the parak into parts and try to understand who is he speaking to, what is he addressing, and what is he essentially arguing. So let's start from the beginning again and do this in small pieces. This is where the hard work of Kohelet begins. Up until now we've dealt with the broad picture issues. From here, for the next, really till the end of the Sefer, we're going to get to the hard work of text by text, trying to break this Sefer apart and understand what's going on. V'shavti ani va'areh et kol ha'ashukim asher nasim tachat ha'shamash. I'm back to the beginning. I looked, or turned, and saw all of the oppressed under the sun. V'ine dim'ata ashukim ve'en lehem menachem. And I saw the tear of the oppressed, with none to comfort or none to care. Umiyad oshkehem koach, with strength belonging to the oppressor. Ve'en lehem menachem. And nobody is comforting, meaning nobody cares. Therefore, conclusion, Shabeach ani et hametim shekvar metu min hachayim asher hem chayim adena, v'tov mishnehem et asher aden lo haya. I praised the dead over the living, and better than both was the one who has never been. Asher lo ra'a et ha'maaseh ha'ra asher nasa tachat ha'shamash. Because he never saw the evil under the sun. The evil in this case referring to the oppression. Who is he addressing and what is he addressing? Who could he be addressing? And what? Let's put ourselves back into the context of the book. What's been said? Where did we leave off? And what essentially is the message? I have to do a quick review of 2 weeks ago, because last week we didn't study Kohelet, so we have to go back. Who was our last speaker? The Nehne. Our last speaker was the Nehne, and for all intents and purposes, he's really been the only speaker, because the beginning was an introduction, and all the voices all mixed into one. So it stands to reason that our Amal is addressing some component of the speech of the Nehne. In this case, it's an easy one, because I only have one option. Unlikely that he's addressing that which has not been yet articulated. So assuming that he's responding to the Nehene in some level, what was essentially the conclusion of the Nehene? Where did the Nehene leave off? Fundamentally, what was the message that the Nehene articulated? Who was...
God was going to judge. Don't worry. If there's bad things in the world, leave it to God.
Right. Et tzaddik... et harasha yishpot ha'elokim ki et v'chol chefetz ve'al kol ma'aseh. The righteous and the wicked will be judged by God. There is accountability for everything. Don't worry. Where will that accountability take place?
Sham.
Sham, as we say. There. As far as the here and now is concerned, mi yavienu lirot b'mashiach harav, his conclusion was, who is going to bring a person to be able to see what's beyond the veil? It's not possible. And therefore, for now, matar adam ala behema ayin ki hakol havel. The advantage of man over beast is nothing. Eat, drink, enjoy, benefit from the world. You can't be responsible for the world. Accountability, responsibility for justice, for goodness, for evil. Mishpat, judgment, is the domain of God. Just as accountability and responsibility is the domain of God. And as philosophy is predicated on the notion that we as God's creations are not capable of taking responsibility for this world. God is in control completely. God is in control. God has set a timetable for everything in this world. We benefit from the ride. There's evil in the world. Makom mishpat shama harasha, makom ha tzadik shama harasha. There's evil, there's injustice, there's wickedness. You're right. There's evil, there's injustice, there was wickedness. And who's going to deal with it? God. Concludes the Nehenah. Opening salvo of the Amal. In one word. In one word. Intolerable. Unacceptable. Gewalt. Picture a world for a moment in which there are only two types of people. The oppressed and the oppressor. That's the world you've created. There's no accountability. There's no responsibility. You've left man to his beast character. Dim'ata ashukim. There is nothing but the tear of the oppressed. V'ra'iti dim'ata ashukim. I saw the tear of the oppressed. And there's none to comfort them. Why is there none to comfort them? Because in the world you've created, Nehenah, in the world you've created, there's no accountability. So who's going to comfort the oppressed? To comfort the oppressed means not to turn around to the oppressed and stroke their back and say, I'm sorry. To comfort the oppressed means to say, I'll do something about it. There's no comfort to the oppressed in sympathy. To comfort the oppressed means to change the world, to do something, to take responsibility for this world. Not to tolerate evil and oppression. V'ra'iti et kol ha'ashukim ve'en la'em menachem. In the world of the Nehenah, this evil goes unchecked and continues for generation after generation. Because we've thrown all responsibility for it up to the heavens, leaving man completely free to pillage and kill with nobody to hold them accountable. That, says the Amal, is a completely intolerable situation. And if you create such a world, the Mishabech Aniyat HaMetim Shekvar Metu, then I would praise the dead over the living. Because such a world is not worth living. Such a world is not worth living. better than both the living and the dead is the one who was never born, because he says why. Right? Because he never has to experience the evil. You've created a world where there is only two types of people in this world, the oppressor and the oppressed. There's nobody to stand up to the oppressed, to the oppressor. There's nobody to stand up and say there's got to be a better way. We have to create a world that's a good place to live in. Because to do that, you have to take responsibility for the world. And the ideological foundation of the Nehenneh is that we are not only absolved of responsibility, but we are incapable of changing God's plan for this world. That's a great cop-out. Makes you sleep well at night. I can't do anything about it. We'll see later in the Sefer, the only one who can't sleep at night in Kohelet is the Amal. And he'll say it. He says, I can't sleep at night. Because I'm too busy worried about how to fix this world. The Nehenneh sleeps very nicely because there's nothing he can do about it. And the Yirei Elokim sleeps well at night because he has Emunah, that there's a better way. The only one who can't sleep will get to the Chacham, but the only one who really can't sleep is the Amal. Because Taka, he's so distraught at this notion of Maseh Hara, this evil, this Dimata Ashukim, this tear of the oppressed. For whom in the world of the Nehenneh there's nothing you can do about it, creates a completely intolerable existence. In such a world, there's only two options: either to die or never to have been born. And that's exactly what he says. V'tov mishnemat asher aden lo haya asher lo ra'a at maaseh hara shenasah tachat ha'shamash. And with that, the Amal has essentially introduced to us the fundamental difference between his ideological framework and that of the Nehenneh. The symptom is their personality. The Nehenneh eats and drinks and enjoys as a receiver, recipient of God's goodness. The Amal will take responsibility for the world, ignore God. Because total and complete responsibility for humankind is on our shoulders. There's no place for God in the worldview of the Amal. Not because he doesn't believe in God. There's no such thing as an atheist in biblical terms. But because God has no place in the world model. If the question at hand is who is responsible for the world we live in, who ultimately carries responsibility? To the Nehenneh, that responsibility rests on the shoulders of God. And to the Amal, responsibility rests on the shoulders of man. Those are my two extremes. And that's it. Only two options here. So the Nehenneh talks only about God, and the Amal talks about man to the exclusion of God. There's no third option. Till the Yirei Elokim enters the picture, which is not yet. And that's why he talks only about himself. Remember that egocentric chapter 2 where he talked about himself 93 times? Without any reference to God? Because the worldview of the Amal, it's all on his shoulders. That's an enormous weight to carry. But he's willing and able and he's willing and prepared to carry that weight. But that's the ideological framework from which the Amal begins. Responsibility rests on my shoulders. The personalities, this one eats and enjoys, and this one is toiling and building, are symptoms. They're the end result of the core difference in philosophical perspective. The core difference is the question of who is responsible to make a difference in this world. Is it me or is it God? And clearly he's not prepared to leave responsibility in the hands of God. And he's fully prepared to take responsibility onto his own shoulders and then draw the conclusions. So that's the opening passage. It's essentially a rejection of the Nehenneh, who has created this scenario of Dim'ata Ashukim, the tear of the oppressed, and left it unchecked. Ve'en le'em menachem. But he hasn't told us yet what his campaign policies are going to be. He's only rejected the platform of the other guy. So we still have work to do. Probably going to raise taxes. That's one solution. Shlomo tried that too. Got him into a lot of trouble eventually. Comes a point where you can raise him so high that... anyway. Pasuk Dalet. V'ra'iti ani. It's interesting to note, throughout this parak, he has this phrase, V'ra'iti ani, I saw. And it's logical to assume that every time he introduces that phrase, he's taking the next step in the discussion, whatever the next piece is. But it's usually some kind of introduction to a transition from one part of his speech to another. V'shavti ani, v'ra'iti ani, I saw, I turned. And these are phrases that lead us from one section to the next. V'ra'iti ani et kol amal v'et kol kishron ma'aseh. I looked at all of my toil, all of the toil and the value of deed, kihi kinat, what the achievement of deed, kihi kinat ish mere'eu, which is the result of jealousy one to another. Gam ze hevel ru'utruach, this too is vanity and broken spirit. Haksil choveket yadav v'chalet b'saro, the fool clasps his hands and eats his own flesh. Tov melochafnachat mimelochafnayim amal urutruach. Better a spoonful of minucha, of rest and joy, than two fistfuls of toil and broken spirit. Veshavti ani ve'ere hevel tachat hashamesh. Again, I turned and I saw evil under the sun. Yesh echad ve'en sheni gam ben va'achen lo. There's one. There's not two. There's not no child. There's no brother. There's no end to all the toil. He'll never see the end of it. He'll never be satiated with it. For whom am I doing all of this toil? And exasperating my soul. This is evil. And evil spirit, evil and broken spirit. What's his issue here?
When he's talking about rivalry between men, is it competition?
Oh. I'll come back to that in a second. That's correct. I think he is talking about competition. Okay. Come back to it. But before we do, let's just take one step back and say, what is he doing here? What's his goal here? What in this section of this of his talk. What is he looking at and what is he concluding?
There seems to be some notion if you're active, as you say, you do something, you do it as an individual, or you do it with some notion of relatedness to others or the common good.
Okay, you're again a step ahead of me. You're at the substance. I'm not at the substance yet, just at the form. What is he doing at this section of the text? What is he analyzing? Of?
Of man.
Specifically, what aspect of man? His work. His drive. In other words, he's assessing the motivation, the value of toil and effort. He's argued that the philosophical worldview of the Nene is intolerable. We have to work, we have to do, we have to take responsibility. Once he's argued that, he now has to analyze what that value is. So he's raised a flag. That flag is toil and effort. Amal and kishron ma'aseh. Ra'iti ani. So now I have to assess it. I have to evaluate it. And his evaluation has led him to the conclusion that there are two fundamental flaws in an idea, in a framework of amal and kishron ma'aseh. There are two problems here. What's interesting to note, what are those two problems? there's no end to it is a component of the problem. And it's a component of the second problem. What's the first problem?
Competition.
The first problem is that the drive to build, the drive to create, the motivation, more often than not, is not motivated by the ideological picture of evil in this world and the attempt to resolve that evil. More often than not, it's a result of kinat ish mere'ehu. Jealousy and competition. What motivates a human being? And the second problem is
aloneness.
Solitude. No air. Who is it all for? Ulemi ani amelu mechaseret nafshi. If there's no im ben en lo v'kam ach en lo, I have no son, I have no brother. There's nobody to leave it to. There's nobody to give it over to. It's going to be short lived. What's interesting about both of these is that essentially, if I were to ask you the question, does this person who has articulated these two problems in his own personal ideological beliefs, is he somebody who accepts the value of toil and the achievement of effort? Or is he somebody who has rejected Amal as a philosophical position? On the surface of it, it sounds like he's rejecting it. But if you think about it, the question of Kinat Ishmaeyeh, which is a question of motivation, is not a rejection of Amelut per se. It's a recognition that there is some flaw here. There's nothing per se bad about building and creating and achieving. But there's a problem with the motivation. If I can solve the problem of the motivation, the result is still of value. The second problem as well, the fact that I could do all of this building and creating and end up with nobody to leave it to. That's also an external problem. It can sometimes happen, but it's not a problem that's identified with the core philosophical position of what that I am responsible for this world and I have to do something about it. He's challenged by two problems. He needs to solve those two problems. But if he can solve the specific symptoms, his core position of responsibility for building and creating is still valid. So again, it's the conductor criticizing his own orchestra. Understanding the nuances of the philosophical position he's addressing, that of taking responsibility for the world and building and creating, he's analyzed its own shortcomings, but they're external to the fundamental belief that there is value to Kishron Masa. I'll go one step further. Yes?
Why is the fact that work might be motivated by jealousy, why is that necessarily...
When we get to each one of these, we're going to analyze it further. But for now, I just wanted to see the forest that the forest, the trees a little bit.
If somebody's trying to rectify the situation of the oppressor and the oppressed, that usually doesn't come, that's a selfless kind of thing. I'm trying to get justice in the world. It's not jealousy, is it? If somebody sees a wrong and they want to right it.
Okay, well, I'll analyze that in a moment.
Jealousy.
We'll analyze it in a moment. We'll question, we'll try to understand what he's getting at. Just hold it for a moment. I'll come back to it in a second. I'm going to do each one separately. But before I do, there's two verses here that we have to explain because they throw a monkey wrench into everything we've said. And that is Psukim Hei and Vav. Well, let's do Vav in particular. Somebody explain Pasuk Vav to me. Tov Meloch Hafnachat Meloch Hafnaim Amal Ur'ut Ruach. at this pasuk first. Tov melech hafnachat mimelech hafnayim amal ur'ut ruach. What does it mean? Just a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down? Not quite. Better a spoonful, kaf, of nachat. What is nachat? Not nachas. Nachat. Right? Rest. From the word menucha. Tov melech hafnachat. Better a spoonful of rest, relaxation. It's the opposite of work. Then two fists full of work and utruach. Doesn't sound to me like something the Amal would say. Does it sound to you like it's something the Amal would say?
Well,
no.
It might be, because if you're saying that he gives a critique, okay, superficially.
A superficial external critique. He's not throwing in the towel.
But that's not throwing in the towel. That's modifying.
Tov melech hafnachat mimelech hafnayim amal ur'utruach is not throwing in the towel?
No, why should it be?
I'd rather a spoonful of rest and relaxation than two fistfuls of work and effort. That's not throwing in the towel from the Amal's perspective?
No.
That's not throwing in the towel. I don't know what is. This sounds to me like it's the words of the Nenek. The Nenek could say something like that. I'd rather one spoonful of good bath, nice hot bath, than two fistfuls of hard work and labor. Doesn't sound.
You're kind of prejudicing by calling it ruach.
Oh yeah, this is what I do with this pasuk in the middle of the speech of the Amal. Hold that problem for a moment. Let's look at pasuk Hey. Haksil choveket yadav v'ochelet bisaro. Haksil choveket yadav v'ochel et bisaro. The fool clasps his hands and eats or consumes his flesh. What does that mean? Excuse me?
The
Chacham could talk in such a language, but we haven't seen the Chacham yet, so let's leave the Chacham out of the discussion. What does it mean? Who eats his flesh? Well, in the context of the fool, but in the context of Qohelet, who could be described as somebody who eats his flesh? Let me rephrase it. Eats his life away.
The
Nenek. The Nenek. Right? So now, take a look at this pasuk. What is Haksil choveket yadav v'ochelet bisaro? Who's the Ksil? Who's the fool?
So the Amal could be saying.
Clearly, that is an accusation against the Amal, levied by the Amal. And clearly, that is a pejorative jab by the Amal against the Nehneh. Haksil choveket yadav v'chaleb b'saro. The fool clasps his hands together, meaning
he's
not doing anything. He's not doing anything. He's sitting back and eating his own, consuming his own flesh, because he's consuming the world around him. Why is Haksil choveket yadav v'chaleb b'saro? Because the Ksil looks at the world and he sees people toiling in effort and building, and he sees that it's kinat ish mereyeyu, that it's jealousy one against the other, and it's motivated by jealousy and motivated by competition and motivated by all of these negative factors, and the neheneh / ksil comes to the only logical conclusion he thinks you can come to, which is chovek et yadav v'ochel et b'saro. And then suddenly I have this tov melech hafnachat melech hafnayim amal rut ruach. Answer? Oh. The answer is that Tanakh does not have any syntax in it. So we have to put the syntax in for it. So if I read it as two separate psukim and each one stands alone, I'm confused. But if I do this, now it makes sense? Mm-hmm. Well, you're going to have to come around the other side of the room to understand what I just did. I can imagine.
Pretending I'm looking at the website. That's not my comment.
Haksil choveket yadav ochelet b'sarod. The ksil, in response to the problem of kinat ishmarayeh, clasps his hands together, gives up, throws in the towel, eats his own flesh, and says, Tov m'loch hafnachat m'loch hafnayim amalurut ruach. He's prepared to say, better a spoonful of nachat than two fistfuls of amalut ruach. That may be the response of the nehneh, but at the end of the day, the nehneh is nothing but a fool. He's a ksil. Because what we're dealing with is a challenge, not a fundamental issue. Challenges can be solved. Problems can be turned into opportunities. The fact that there is a negative motivation to creativity in this world is not a reason to throw in the towel on creativity. Is it correct to say that there is a negative motivation to creativity in building and creating, and that people are, for the most part, or at least in significant amount, motivated by self-achievement and jealousy? Is it correct to assume that most accomplishments in this world, be they physical accomplishments, scientific accomplishments, creation and creativity, art, is motivated for the most part by the desire to make not only an impact in this world, but an impact that one can take to the bank? I think it's a fair assessment. The world had one experiment in recent history, an attempt to remove motivation from a society. It was called communism, and it was an abysmal failure. Because Kohelet recognized correctly so that the reality is, for most people, the motivation to achieve and to accomplish is motivated by kinat ish mere'eyo. Jealousy and the desire to self-serve. We're human beings. Does that mean we throw in the towel? No. It just means we have to find a way to resolve the problem, the challenge of an inherent negative flaw in society. Does the flaw exist? I think so. I think it's correct to say that the flaw exists. Are there people who are so altruistic that they can rise above that basic human nature of jealousy and self-serving achievement? Yes. But as a whole, society works best when we're in competition with each other. The truth is, Chazal said the same thing. Kinat sofrim tarbe chokhmah. That when scribes are jealous of each other, wisdom increases in the world. Academic jealousy, business jealousy. My next door neighbor made a mint on the stock market. Guess what I'm going to do tomorrow? I'm going to call him up and say, what stocks did you invest in? I'm going to go make try to make my mint. That's how we operate. And that's how we achieve things in this world. So I have to figure out a way to resolve the negativity of it, but not necessarily to reject it, as the fool would do. That's number one. Number two. Ulamiani, what was the problem number two? Problem number two is a very interesting description. Pasuk Chet. Yesh echad ve'en sheni. Alone. One without two. Gam ben va'ach ein lo. Having neither. Gam ben va'ach ein lo. I have no one to inherit it. I have no one to leave it to. That's a fascinating position for the Amal to take. Why? Well, we'll get to that problem. That's true, that it's an exception rather than the rule, and that raises a question of whether or not I can build a philosophy out of what seems to be an exception. But for Kohelet, for the Amal, it's a fascinating position to take because it's a maturing of sorts. This is not the first time Kohelet has raised the question of a Yorish. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
First time was back in Perek Bet. And there the question was raised in a different context. Mm-hmm. Namely, why should I bother with all of this work and effort and toil? She'anichenu le'adam she'yeh acharai. And I should have to leave it to the one who comes after me. Namely, my son. So what are you doing? And we were shocked by the expression. It was so harsh. It was so self-centered. Can a human being be so self-centered that he calls his son the one who comes after me? The Amal has come a long way. He's prepared, fully prepared, to toil and work on behalf of somebody else. But now he has a new problem. Namely, maybe he won't have somebody. Potentially, possibly, maybe he won't have somebody. So now he has to resolve that challenge. What do I do with the possibility that there's nobody to work for?
He's a real pessimist.
Kohelet in general is a pessimist. I think his pessimism is driven by his own personal experiences. And that we're going to get to at the end of the parak. I think he's pessimistic for a reason. But you're correct. There is a certain failure in his assessment, which is why he wrote the book. If he had discovered America, he wouldn't have written the book.
He could have named it after himself.
There you go. We'd all be living in Solomon Town.
Is the phrase alone and solitary man who has neither son or brother two different ideas that are they qualify one another, like you could be a lone and solitary man who had a son and brother, or have a son and brother be alone. That gets back to whether you're part of a community or connected.
Well, we'll get to the community in a moment. I don't think he's describing a sort of existential loneliness here. I don't think he's that.
I'm not even thinking of existential, just whether somebody connects with other people besides his family. Or
on a social level? I mean, like a social interaction?
Not social, in terms of the purpose or goal of their work.
Well, the goal of the work is to offer it to is to eventually leave it to somebody because you're not going to live forever.
Yeah.
Right. The goal is to leave it to somebody because you're not going to live forever. That's the problem.
Right. So is it either family or community?
Well, we haven't discussed community yet. We've only discussed the finality of Gam ben va'ach ein lo. He has no son nor brother. All he is alone. Nobody to work for, nobody to leave it to. We'll come to up with his solution will obviously lie in the domain of the community, but we haven't gotten to a solution yet.
Why does jealousy have to be a factor in all that? Because
it's a negative.
Can a person achieve himself? He doesn't have to compete with his neighbor, just for the sake of achievement.
Reality is that we are driven by competition. We'll call it jealousy, call it competition. It's what drives the world. If you take that away from people, then ultimately you take away motivation. So that was the experience of the 20th century. Yeah, that was Kohelet's experience.
You know, he's concerned about not having anybody to leave it to. It sounded what it means like he was not having anybody to share it with.
I don't see it because I don't see it in the context of any of his chapters. And Perek Bet was certainly worried about who he's going to leave it to.
No, I'm
right? Remember that we're dealing with the overall issue here is the shadow that's created by death. And his solution certainly doesn't resolve the question of who to share. Well, maybe partially resolves the issue of who to share.
Brother might, die before then.
We'll get to that issue too. We'll get to the issue in later on. He deals with the case of somebody who has a partner, and then the partner dies.
Why isn't one and two connect on the idea that if there's striving and motivation, competition, then the second part would be if you're alone, there's no legacy, which is kind of the other part, if you will, of the motivation and the competition.
Yeah, they could be connected. They could be connected. I think one is what drives a person to go to work, and the other is what drives one's coming from behind, and one's going ahead. One is what's pushing me forward, and the other is what's the purpose? What's it all going for? What's my goal? But his solution to both of them lies along the same lines. And I think that's why they are connected, ultimately. His solution to both of them is... What's the solution? He offers a solution. He absolutely offers a solution.
He goes to wisdom versus to the fool. Wisdom could address...
He has not introduced wisdom yet. Where does he introduce wisdom? We'll get to the wise youth. We're not there yet. We're at Pasuk Tet. We're jumping ahead of him. We're at Pasuk Tet. What's the solution? Oh, his solution is Tovim Ashnayim Min HaEchad. His solution is to take on a partner. Tovim Ashnayim Min HaEchad. And then he goes through a whole description of why a partnership is of value. How does a partnership solve his problem? The partnership solves both problems. It solves the problem of competition, because now I'm not working against my partner. I am working with them. I'm going to share. And I'm not alone, because I have a partner. So it's a simple solution. It's so simple a solution that you wonder why it's here, but I'll show you where it goes in a moment. So he starts with two. Tovim ha-shnayim min ha-echad. Two are better than one. Why? Sheyesh lehem sechar tov v'amalav. Two are better than one because they double the reward. They double the work. And you split the risk.
And they help each other.
And that's exactly what he says. Kim yipolu ha-echad yakim et chavero. If one falls, the second will help him pick him up. That's called sharing the risk. Two can warm each other, they can help each other. And if one is attacked, the second will stand with him. Up through Pasuk Yud Gimel. First half of Pasuk Yud Gimel.
So Tet through Yud Gimel 1. Solution is how many?
Two.
Does that mean marriage? Because then the next thing is...
He's not talking about marriage.
Because then the next thing is three.
Correct. He's not talking about marriage. He's talking about in a work environment.
Okay.
He's not talking about marriage. Mm-hmm. He's not dealing with the social component of this. This is the Kohelet is dealing with the achievement of society. Marriage is too small an issue for this discussion right now. The achievements of society as a whole. Next... והחוט המשולש לא במהרה ינתק. Go from 2 to
3.
And from 3 to
4.
From 4 to 5, etc., etc. The moment I have 2, I have a progression. And essentially what is argued is that there is a solution to this problem. The solution lies not in the domain of the individual, but in the domain of a collective. 2, 3, 4. The more, the better. We can move to a corporation. And if you have a corporation, you have a lot of people working together. And they share the risk, and they have limited liability, all kinds of things you can create in the corporation. And then if you really want to take it to the next level, in the fundamental goal of avoiding the issue of kinat ish mereyu, because in a corporation they all share, right? Nobody gets more than anybody else. And? Right? And? I don't have to worry about a Yoresh, because the corporation continues. And you go further and go on from there. 2, 3, 4, 5. Where does it stop? How large a corporation? 100 workers? 1,000 workers? Where does it stop? There's no end. And the result, therefore, is, where does it go? It goes to somewhere where Kohelet doesn't mention, but he will respond to. There's an interim piece between Pasuk Yud Gimel and Pasuk Yud Dalid, or Pasuk Yud, actually, this is all Yud Bet. My apologies. I read this wrong. This is all you bet. Okay? Between Pasuk Yud Bet and Pasuk Yud Gimel, there's a break. He'll respond to that break in a moment, but before we get there, what's the next level up? Individual? Partnership? Group? Corporation? What's the next? What's the largest unit? Society as a whole, globally, is too large a group, but a kingdom works. And the advantage of a kingdom is that with a kingdom, not only do you have a collective that has a shared vision and a shared goal, but you now also have a representative of that collective. You have a leader. And with that leader, you can now begin to address the fundamental challenges that drive the Amal to do what he wants to do. Namely, perpetuation is only the problem of what do I do all this good for if I can't perpetuate it? But the fundamental problem that he's facing is oppression. Remember, at the end of the day, the Amal is looking for a solution to the problem of tzedek in this world.
What if the king's the oppressor?
Oh, well, that's his... Wait till we get to Yud Gimel, Yud Aleph, and Tetvav, and we'll get to that answer. But first, let's understand the solution, and we'll understand the challenge to the solution. Kohelet will end up a very depressed person at the end of this parak, but we'll get there. But first, he has a solution, namely, the Melech. It's a brilliant solution. Why? What is the fundamental responsibility of a king? To take care of his people. Not only to take care of his people, a king has two jobs. If you had to give a job description for a king, certainly in the biblical context, and even post-biblical, even to an extent today, till society today, if you substitute king with government, there are essentially two areas of responsibility that government leadership has. One, right? To protect us from our enemies. Correct. To protect us from our enemies. Right? To be the leader of the army so that we can protect us from potential threats, whether they be next door to us or they be across the globe. But to protect us from our enemies. Number one. And that's why King was always the leader of the army, right? Historically and until today. Right? There is a military attached to every government in the world, because that's part of what a king is responsible to do, to maintain, to protect his people from outside threats. Job number one. Job number two, internal justice, to be a judge, mishpat, essentially to protect us from ourselves, or to establish law and order, to protect the internal dynamic of a society. And that's always why the king has two roles. He is the matzbi, he is the warrior, he is the general, and he is the shofet. Shlomo HaMelech sits on the throne as a... David HaMelech was the great warrior. Shlomo HaMelech's claim to fame in the world was... He was a shofet. They came to him from all over the world to hear his wisdom and his judgments. For 350 years, we called the kings of Israel shoftim. They were kings. They were warriors. We called them judges. Because the roles were so intertwined. Shmuel Hanavi, when he tells the people who come to him and ask for a king, and he says to them, you want the king, do you know what a king can do? A king can confiscate your children, he can put them into his army, a king can judge you. A king can hold you accountable. A king can... Mishpat HaMelech, he doesn't need a jury, he doesn't need a trial. He has unilateral authority. He has a police force at his command. That's what a king can do. Because a king who has all of that power can use that power for what purpose? He can abuse it. But he's not there yet. Idealistically, a king can use all that power to be judge. And what is the role of a judge?
No oppression.
To remove oppression from this world.
Let me put the let me put it into a simple sentence. In the world view of the Nehneh, at the tzaddik v'tarasha yishpata elokim, the righteous and the wicked will be judged by God. Ki et l'chol chefetz v'al kol ma'aseh. Where? Sham. In the world view of the Amal. Finish this sentence. At the tzaddik v'tarasha. Finish this sentence. Yishpot hamelech.
Here.
That's the fundamental difference between the Mal and the Nene. If I can't solve the problem, because I'm alone, because I'm an individual, because I'm motivated by jealousy, because it's ineffectual, whatever the issues are, if the individual Amal is not going to solve the problem, I get together with 2 or 3 or 5 or 5,000 or 50,000, I create a Malchus, and I let the Melech, with the power of the community, with the power of the society, I let the Melech solve the problem. And then I have a solution that can really achieve a difference in this world. And the Melech can solve the problem. The Melech can resolve Mishpat. The Melech can eradicate injustice in this world. Great solution? Perfect solution. There's only one flaw. It's been tried and failed. What king in history had more power to him than any king before or after? What king in biblical history sat on the largest empire in our history? Shlomo. Did Shlomo achieve the eradication of Dimata Ashukim from this world? Perfect solution, tried and failed. And you have to ask yourself why. He had everything going for him. What went wrong? And here I think Shlomo answers that question himself. Because that's what he does at the end of this parak. He responds, again, there's that line here before Pasuk Yud Gimel. Melech. Solution. Okay? Let's try it out. Pasuk Yud Gimel. Tov yeled misken v'chacham mimelech zaken uksil asher lo yada lizeher od. The young, poor, wise lad is better than the old, foolish king who could not or did not know how to be careful. Who is he talking about? What is he talking about? Most of the Mefarshim struggle with this question. You have two personalities described here. Yeled. Misken. Bechacham. Melech, Zaken, Uksil. Who are they? No. Not in this case, I don't think. The Medrash says the Yeled Misken V'Chacham, or the Melech, one is the Yetzer Hara, one is the Yetzer Tov. So there's a Medrash that says one is Yosef and the other is Paro. There's all kinds of suggestions in the Medrash. Simplest solution.
If you use the Siyum before, the king becomes a Nen. If you want to use that same word.
I'm not sure it's used in the same application. Ksil is just a general pejorative term, a fool, an idiot.
Same chapter.
It's like calling somebody an idiot. Could be. But I think there's something. I think there's a real person behind these two phrases. Excuse me? The melech zaken uksil lishlomo. Asher lo yadali yizeher od. Who no longer knew how to be careful. Shlomo, the end of Shlomo's life is essentially a testimony to his own failure because he let his wives take over his kingdom. And I don't mean that in the marital sense. I mean that in the idolatry sense. He married 1,000 political wives, thinking he could control them, thinking he could maintain their cultural influences, contain their cultural influences, I should say, and may have been doable when he was young and powerful, but there comes a point when he gets old, and he just can't. He's incapable of doing it. And now he's got all this cultural influence from 1,000 kingdoms running around his own kingdom. Is it any surprise that the country has become overridden with idolatry? Melech zaken v'ksil. And Dafka's an interesting description of Shlomo Melech as a ksil. Because he's usually the chacham. If he is the Melech zaken v'ksil, who is the yeled misken v'chacham? The poor but wise lad.
Young Shlomo before he had power?
Nope. Again? Rechavam. Oh, Rechavam. I dafka think not. But you're close. You're Rechavam. Why do I say you're Rechavam? Ki mi beit hasurim yatzal limloch. Because he emerged to take power from the dungeons, from the prison. Yeravam was a prisoner. He was a political prisoner. He was exiled to Egypt. And what Shlomo Melech is essentially saying is that he recognized at the end of his life, he recognized all the symptoms, he recognized all the signs of the upcoming split and conflict. This Yelid, he's not a king, he's a child. He's a generation younger than Shlomo. Misken, he's poor, he's a prisoner. He's an Eved, he's a slave. But he was wise. He understood the people. Something which Shlomo didn't, and something which his son Rechavam certainly didn't. I would be very hesitant to call Rechavam Chacham. But Yeravam was very smart. Yeled Chacham, Yeled Misken v'Chacham. And look at the potential. Look at the option. This child, this political prisoner, this slave exiled to Egypt, who comes back and overnight wins the hearts of the people, and who speaks of such concepts and principles as social justice, the oppression of Sevel Beit Yosef, of the servitude of the house of Joseph, of Dim'ata Ashukim, the tear of the oppressed. These are the phrases, these are the concepts that Yeravam was building his whole career on. And he was exiled for it, because he was Herim Yad B'Malach. He dare rebel against the king. So the king exiled him. Classic political prisoner. Beware of political prisoners. They can come back to haunt you. And Shlomo Melech knew very well what Yeravam was capable of doing. Don't forget, he saw the crumbling of his own kingdom. Shlomo Melech reigned an empire literally from the Nile to the Euphrates. But the very last events of his own life was another political exile. The son of the king of Aram, who had been exiled by David to Egypt. And when he saw that David had died, and the general of David's army had died, and he saw that the opportunity was right, gathers together an army and goes back to take over Aram. And Aram had been conquered by David. And slowly but surely, Perigud Aleph of Malachim, if you want to look up the story, slowly but surely, Solomon's great empire begins to fall apart. Shlomo saw that. He didn't have to wait till after his death. He saw Aram taken away from him. He saw the periphery of his kingdom taken away. He saw the rift growing between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, an old rift, an ancient rift. We think that the kingdom split after Shlomo HaMelech. It's not true. The rift between Yisrael and Yehuda is a rift that goes back to the days of Joseph, and it really goes back in practical political terms to Sefer Shoftim. It's an old fault line that in the heart of the land of Israel. Shlomo HaMelech watched his kingdom and his empire crumble, and he held it together by its fingernails. And then he saw this prisoner, this kid, who begins to rally the people behind him, Ve'erim Yad B'melech, to revolt against which king? Against Shlomo. The first attack of Yeravam ben Nebat was against Shlomo. That's why he exiled him to Egypt. From the prisons, he's going to emerge to reign. Okay, so maybe I'm no longer the right king for this job. Maybe this job belongs to Yeled, Misken v'Chacham, who spoke of justice, who spoke of Dimat HaShekim. Maybe he'll solve the problems of the world. Shlomo looks far into the future, about 5 years into the future, to project where this kingdom is going to go. 5 years is not so hard to project. Gam b'malchuto nolad rash. In his kingdom too is born evil. Ra'iti et kol ha'chaim ha'malchim tachat ha'shemesh ma'yeled ha'sheni ha'sheyamot tachtav. I saw everything that's going to take place with this young second who's going to come in his stead. There's no end. They won't be happy with him in the future either. He will be unsuccessful. If I couldn't do it, he can't do it. And the result of Imalchut Yeravam, with all his talk of social justice and righteousness and everything else, what does he do? Besides the idolatry that he starts to build? The end of the result of Yeravam's kingdom is a war that costs us 800,000 lives on both sides. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible civil war. And one failure after another. And this great kingdom that started with such a bang about social justice is self-destructive and has more corruption than anything else. Political assassinations and sexual shenanigans, and you name it. All in Malchut Yeravam. Ultimately, it exiles first. 100 years before Malchut Yehuda. So the solution of this Yeled Chacham Yeled Misken V'Chacham doesn't work either. Where does he go from there? That's it. It's finished. He has concluded his speech. Because his one solution failed, not on the ideological front, not on the philosophical front. It didn't fail in the laboratory of philosophy. It failed in real life. It failed because it's human nature. So he's back to the drawing board. Mr. Mal is going to have to go back and rethink his great solution, because his one attempt at a solution on the level of the Tzibur or the Malchus, that one attempt failed. And if he couldn't do it, no Melech can. To Shlomo Melech's worldview, this was it. This was the solution on the communal scale. If it didn't work, he's going to go back to the individual. Because that's where Kohelet starts, that's where he ends. It's a philosophy of the individual. He had one foray into the world of the communal, into the world of the Malchus, didn't do him well, and he'll pull back. And we're left with a failed Nehenneh, because it's intolerable to suggest that injustice can go unchecked. We're left with a failed Amal, although only partially, because ideologically he still believes in Amelut. But practically, he hasn't come up with a solution to the issues of selfishness of human nature and the ultimate goal, which is to make a difference in this world, and if I can't make a difference, then what's it all for? And that's it. He's finished. Where do we go next?
Democracy instead of a kingdom.
Democracy instead of a kingdom is not going to solve either of these problems. Understand something. Let me say a word about Malchus and democracy. It is a misnomer to suggest for a moment that the Torah's concept of a Malchus was a better solution than a democracy. The Torah never entertained the possibility of a democracy because democracy is not a concept in society until much later. It doesn't exist. The vocabulary of it doesn't exist. In biblical terms, there's only two kinds of government: national and tribal. Those are the only two forms of government that exist in the world. One is called a malchus, and the other is called a shofet. Take your pick. We had 350 years of tribal leadership, didn't work. So we went to a national leadership. That's the only difference between malchus and non-malchus. From the Torah's perspective, it's irrelevant whether the power is vested in one person or the power is vested in a group of people. The issue is whether it's local, on the local level, tribal leadership, or on the communal national level, national leadership. That's the only issue.
Was the tribal leadership vested in one person?
Vested in one person, because there was no model of government other than to vest in one person. That's not the issue. But the challenges that the Torah presents, or the failures that the Torah presents to the Shofet or to the Melech, are not solved in a democracy. Democracy solves other problems, but they're not solved by a democracy. A democracy does not speak better to the issues that the Navi presents as the challenges of Malchus or Shofet. Right. The Torah's issue is not a question of democracy over Malchus. It's an issue of individual anarchy, tribal leadership, national government. Translate that as you will. So if modern society, we don't want the power to be vested in one individual because of the possibility of abuse of power, so fine. So divide it amongst 50 individuals, you still have Malchus. Conceptually, you still have Malchus because you still have a national government versus a tribal one. And the authorities of that group are still to wage war and to protect the people. The authorities are still the same, and the job description is still the same, and the model is still the same. From a halachic point of view, it makes no difference. So the issue that we will address has got nothing to do with whether it's a melech or whether it's a democracy. It has to do with whether it's an individual or communal. The same failures can exist at each level. This is very important to understand the transition between Sefer Shoftim and Sefer Shmuel, but we're not studying either of those books, but Zvat Hashem, one day we will. This is the theme that we'll come back to. But I think it's a mistake to impose a view that says, this is the famous machloket with the Abarbanel and the Mishonim, as to whether or not there's a mitzvah of Minui Melech. Because they were dealing with a world in which there was abuse of power of the king, and they were beginning to struggle with the question of democracy. So they all focused on the question of, oh, well, wait, maybe a king isn't such a good idea, maybe we should have a democracy. But in the vocabulary of the Torah, that's not the issue. The vocabulary of the Torah, it's not whether you have a king or whether you have a democracy, it's whether you have a king, whether you have tribal anarchy, tribal leadership. So one has to put that into perspective. All right, that's an aside. Again, we will adjourn here.